Labor Committee Farm Worker Housing Work Group. Welcome you all to the table. It has been important to me to look at this issue, to see what we can do to further essentially alleviate the problem that we currently have in Oregon. I think most people would identify the housing shortage that we have. The question is how do we get there? We had a task force that met and called the Farm Worker Housing Interim Task Force, and they came up with a final report and hadn't introduced it to anybody until they introduced it to the House Business and Labor Committee. I guess last week it was. We kind of blend into each other here. But we wanted to take some action because they had 18 recommendations. Some of those are pretty strictly ways and means recommendations that would be hard probably to turn into the legislation that ultimately wouldn't have to go there anyway. But there are other proposals that, numbering 8, 9, maybe 10 proposals that we thought we could probably turn into legislative concepts and try to move through. But we wanted to get some input before we did that and see if there was anything else that we might be missing. We might have missed on the first go-around or that's come up since then. So, you know, just an informal exchange of information, hopefully to build consensus on legislation, that we'd have a package that we could move forward. This is a public meeting. It's being recorded. It's on the Internet. And I would just ask that we go around the table, introduce ourselves so everyone knows who's here. And at some point I may have to leave the meeting, and hopefully we'll have Representative Rosenbaum here to chair the meeting. But I did want to get it started and get us going down the road to discussion. So let's start over here and introduce ourselves, and then we'll move on from there.
My name is Scott Ashton. I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Association of Nurserymen, and we're on record as supporting the recommendations of the task force.
My name is Ted Hughes, and one of my clients is the manufactured housing industry. We have a particular problem within the industry that may lend itself to a big step forward to solving this problem on farm worker housing. Talked to the chairman. He wanted me to come today and share that with you.
Nassick with the Oregon Farm Bureau. John McCulley and I worked on the asset.
Farm Bureau, working with Tim, basically. Tim and I are kind of sharing, kind of transitioning over to me as we go along.
I'm David Sparks, Deputy
Director of Housing Groups doing housing development.
Peter Hanley with CASA of Oregon, also a task force member.
Bob Castaño has great interest in how our public policy addresses farm worker housing.
Susan Castillo, state senator and a member of the task force.
Juan Ramirez from Pecun, has to take it.
Mario Riquelme, representative.
Thank you. Anybody else step in after we pass by?
Noreen Goplin, a member of the task force.
Anthony Nettles, Oregon Catholic Conference.
Anyone else that we missed as we went around the table?
Second. We are trying to get this out over the Internet. Several people had asked if we would do that because they can't be here. These are the only microphones we have in this room. If you would try to make sure you're near a microphone and speak up and identify yourself if you're going to speak, that would be very helpful to those of us who are trying to get this information out to the world.
Thank you. try to put together the legislative concepts and get them to as many folks before the meeting as possible. And do we have any extra copies of those? Does everybody have either the task force report or the...
We can get more.
The LCs?
I'd take that one there.
Okay, let's get over here.
We got an extra.
There you go. Anyone else in dire need of these legislative concepts? Okay. We'll try to get one more copy. The first one that we had, implement the farm worker housing task force recommendation number one, including the policy statement on statewide housing and the suggested rewrite. Did everybody look that over, and is there any comments on that first recommendation?
Mr. Sheriff, I might comment. I put this together, and based on what I saw in the recommendation in the task force report, I did not find a completely satisfactory statement of housing in the statutes, but this one statewide housing policy 456.550 was as close as we could come. So I don't know if that is what the task force intended or not. But we don't have a copy of the statutes for everybody. I can get that. I can get one copy and read it for you if you'd like to see it.
That'd probably be beneficial. Senator Castillo, do you remember what the task force might have had in mind to work
with?
Well,
as I'm looking here at directly out of our recommendations, it looks to me like what is being cited here is exactly what we had cited in here, ORS 97677 policy, and that's what I see listed here. And then
does everybody have a copy of that policy? It's in the report itself.
Page 2?
Yeah, page 10.
Oh. And then, Jim, I guess the second part of that that's in parentheses, that goes to... That segment came from where?
Again, these are instructions to legislative council. I'm trying to help them out.
Okay.
What my habit has been for legislative council, these are the attorneys that do the writing of the statutes. I make suggestions to them.
Okay.
I'm not an attorney, and I say, this is what we want to accomplish. I suggest language, and then a lot of times, you know, sometimes it comes back to what I suggested, and other times I'm way off. So that's why I've suggested this. I don't know if they know of others. Is there someone here from the housing and community service?
Lynn Parton, could we get Lynn closer to a microphone, maybe just pull up a chair there?
I'm Lynn Parton from Housing and Community Services Department. As I said, I helped draft the task force, and what this would do, the 456.550 is part of our statute for that Housing and Community Services Department. So what that would do is put the policy into a housing place where it might get a little more attention to it.
Mr. Chairman, I have the two locations open here in the statutes if anyone would like to know more what they say. 197 is the policy, and it in that the agricultural workers of the state benefit the social and economic welfare of all the people of Oregon, and it goes on. It has 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs on there. The first paragraph says, every state and local government agency that has powers, functions, or duties with respect to housing, land use, or enforcement of any other law shall exercise its powers, functions, or duties consistently with the state policy declared, then lists a bunch of statutes there. And the second paragraph says, every state and local government agency that finds farm worker activities within the scope of its jurisdiction must make every effort to alleviate unsanitary, unsafe, and overcrowded accommodations. The third paragraph says special efforts should be directed toward mitigating hazards to families and children. The fourth paragraph says all accommodations must provide for the rights of free association to seasonal farm workers in their spaces of accommodation. The policy that we're talking about at 456.550 is a general policy statement in the housing chapter, and it goes on for about a column. Number one says there exists in this state a seriously inadequate supply of and pressing need for safe and sanitary dwelling accommodations. Paragraph 2 goes on to say private lending institutions have been and will continue to be unable to provide necessary financial support. There's more to each of these paragraphs. I'm just kind of paraphrasing. The third paragraph says it is a valid public purpose to provide for the construction, rehab, purchase, leasing, financing, housing. Fourth paragraph says further found that authority and powers conferred. Do you want me to talk any further on this?
Yes, sir.
That's what the general housing policy says.
I guess my suggestion would be that we move it to a section or a statute that is not simply a statement of policy. It's already a statement of policy in the law, and if we want it to actually be the law, we ought to move it into another section that's not simply another statement of policy.
Does anyone need more copies of the proposal?
Yes. Any other comments regarding that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
John McCulley representing Tree Fruit Growers. I think it's supposed to be a statement of policy. In 1989, when it was adopted, it was intended to be a broad policy statement that would guide all of the efforts, and I think it continues to fulfill that purpose. I agree with the move to put it in the housing statutes, but I think it still should be a statement of policy.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Peter Hanley. In the initial discussion, the first meeting of the task force, one of the things that came up with this policy was the fact that it was not being implemented by all of the agencies. And so that was one of the main reasons why I think this recommendation was included in here, was that we wanted to make sure that agencies were notified again that, look, this is what the policy is. We need to work together and enforce it. And I think that one of the other recommendations to make Housing Community Services the lead facilitator is an effort to try and do that enforcement.
Okay. Any other comments or questions?
Yes, Chairman, just to comment on the policy statement itself and recommendation one under 197.677, section 2, line 2, appears the same word insanitary, and I wonder if that is a typo in unsanitary.
Exactly.
I believe you are right.
We support them.
We might want to identify that for legislative council. And it may be a typo. Any other questions or comments? Thank you. We had in here, did we skip? No, we went right on to number 3, didn't we?
Yes, and the reason is because number 2 is already in Senate Bill 333.
So everybody can mark that down. That's already underway. Do we know the status of that in the Senate yet? No? Yes, sir.
Chairman, David Sparks, the bill has been assigned to revenue. It's not come up yet for a hearing, but I expect it will in not too distant future.
Recommendation number 3. Extend the carryover period for the tax credit from 5 to 10 years. Seems pretty straightforward. Any comments or questions regarding that one?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question so I can understand this. The tax credit goes to lending institutions, is that correct? Is there any portion of the tax credit that goes to any entity aside from a lending?
Charlie, how Harris with the Community Development Law Center. Yeah, there's actually two tax credits that we're talking about here. One is for lenders, and that already is a 10-year commitment. That's ORS 317. And there's a second tax credit for investors, for growers, for others, and that's ORS 315. And I believe that that's what this policy would be aimed at. The lender tax credit is a 10-year credit already.
How is it envisioned that that the landowner might take advantage of an income tax credit? How would that work on the practice?
In two regards. One is the, just so everybody understands what we're talking about here, in case there's no, the ORS 315 tax credit, which is for investors and growers, says that you get up to 30% of your investment back as a credit if you invest in farm worker housing. And that would be over a 5-year period now. And then there's a, they could also, if they go to borrow money at a bank for that farm worker housing, they can get a, the bank could take a credit on that interest rate that they charge. In practice, in theory, that was to encourage banks to invest in farm worker housing. Back in 1989, as John said, when this policy all came about, there were few banks who were actually interested in lending on farm worker housing. That has now changed quite a bit. There's quite a bit of interest in banks in lending on this. And what this has really come to do is kind of provide a interest rate subsidy of sorts. In other words, the banks have been willing to pass along that credit in the form of a reduced interest rate to the to borrowers. So those are the two ways that a person could take advantage of these credits. One, through either getting a credit for their investment in housing, and that could either be a grower or it could be just an investor. They can take those credits as well if they're investing in housing. So, for example, Peter's group, CASA of Oregon, can develop housing and sell, and basically have an investor put money into that housing and get a credit for the money that they put in. Likewise, Peter's group could go to a bank and get a loan and get some reduced interest rate on that.
Now, CASA of Oregon, is it not a nonprofit association?
It is. It's a nonprofit organization.
Is a nonprofit association authorized to be tax credit now, or is that one of the recommendations?
I think the recommendation is to make it clear that they couldn't, that the practice has been to transfer that credit, and I think the recommendation is to make it clear that that's a legitimate thing to do.
Is there anything to compel the lending institution to pass along that portion of the interest rate?
No.
Other than CRA credits, maybe reinvestment.
Which is important incentive. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
I would just be, I'm sorry, Charlie Harris with the Community Development Law Center. I'd just be cautious in how this extension is worded because it could well affect the pricing of those credits. In other words, right now there's a 5-year monitoring period, or at least it's assumed to be a 5-year monitoring period. And if you extend that out over 10 years, that means people are going to be getting the credit during the first 5 years, but being responsible for the housing over a 10-year period, and presumably they would price the credit accordingly, there's greater risk involved and they would reduce the pricing perhaps. So I'm not sure what the wording needs to be, but I just express some caution when we go to do that.
Well, we'll note that for the record, and Jim, if you will pass that caution on to LC when they do this draft, we'd appreciate it. Thank you. Any other questions or comments on recommendation number 3? Seeing none, we'll move on to recommendation number 4. This one would provide for a transfer of 80% of the farm worker tax credit to parties who construct, manufacture, install, or finance the construction or rehabilitation of farm worker housing. Jim, did you have any thing to add to that? Or am I doing your job? Do I get extra pay, by the way, if I do your job?
You can set up here with us. Jim Stambridge again, for the record. I don't have the background on tax credits to know much more about how to do this. So I just, you can see by my instructions on here, I'm telling Legislative Council, take care of this.
Okay. We've had Representative, the Honorable, and former Representative Mannix join us, who chaired the report, the task force, and he has some comments for us, I think.
I would just like to explain that the reason for this is that sometimes the primary party, to be blunt about it, farmers are often losing money, and they lose money for several years in a row, and they're not in any position to benefit from a tax credit when there's no taxes to pay because they've lost money. And if they want to develop farm worker housing, others who do business with the farmer may be willing to step forward and provide the funds and get the packaging, because they would then be eligible for part of the tax credit as an incentive to build the farm worker housing. And that's the reason for this recommendation.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, what is the percentage right now? This provides a transfer of 80% of the farm worker tax credit to the parties. What is the percentage of the tax credit that is allowed now?
There's nothing in the statute that provides for any transfer.
Nothing. So this would be a new provision to allow the transfer of that 80%.
Yes.
Does that apply both to 217 and 215 or 315 tax credits?
Well, I was Charlie Harris. I was just going to say that while it may be that this should apply to the grower, the 315 tax credit, which can be used by either growers or nonprofits, and nonprofits in turn would sell it, the growers might want to insist on this 20% holdback. But I think as a practical matter for the nonprofits, they'd want to be able to transfer the full 100% of the credit.
That's a legitimate distinction, since they won't ever be in a position. But one reason we had only 80% was we did not want this to become a pure transfer provision where you just get to walk in and say, well, I'm going to pass on the tax credits to whomever. There had to be some holdback. The idea was that tax credits are there to give incentives to those who pay taxes. And this will allow the same incentive for the nonprofits working with outside agencies as for the farmer working with outside agencies. We didn't want to create a preference for one over the other in terms of availability of the credit, in terms of dealing with outside parties. We didn't want competition to develop about, well, I'd rather go with this over that because they have more tax credit available percentage-wise. So we wanted to keep the, use that old action, the level playing field.
So is the intent of this language to allow it to be transferred to lending institutions?
Yes.
Of any sort, whether they're...
The idea is to get as many people into this game as possible by saying, here is... Now, frankly, if the farmer is making money, the farmer doesn't want to transfer the tax credit. The farmer wants that tax credit. Or the nonprofit will want to... It will also be able to entice by transferring the tax credit. The farmer who's not making money wants to be able to build a housing, and that's actually the worst time for them to build housing. They need, if they're losing money, those who might finance that housing are really going to be leery of dealing with it. And that's the time when they most need to be able to say to the financing institution, well, guess what, if you lend me money, some of this can be in the form of a tax credit to you as an incentive to loan me money, even though I may be a higher risk because I've lost money for 3 years. You know, you're financing a building on my farm, and I've been losing money for years. The idea was, yes, to provide an incentive even for the financial community to come in and provide the financing for the construction of the housing for the workers. That was, so we, yeah. Otherwise, I was thinking, yeah, why do these rich bankers need a tax credit? Only because they won't provide the assistance in the very times when the farmer most needs to share and get others to come in. That was the rationale.
Peter?
Mr. Chair, Peter Hanley with CASA. I might clarify that the initial application is not going to be the nonprofit. It's going to be the tax-paying entity, just so everybody knows that, that typically for our projects has been a bank. For a grower, it's typically going to be the grower himself that applies for that.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on recommendation number four? If not, we're going to move to recommendation number five. Jim, did you want to read that for us?
Well, it just says the implement Farm Worker Housing Task Force recommendation number 5, increase the cap to 7.5 million per year, restore tax credits to 50% of eligible costs. The current basis limit is 30% of 3.3 million, and I'm not sure, I was not able to find the limitations in statute.
Anybody else shed any light on that?
If I may, I'm trying to remember where the limitation was. Well, the 3.3 million was actually the amount that's just available.
Okay.
The 30%, I'm not sure where that came from.
Mr. Chair, if I'm...
Yeah, I can try.
Try this. Actually occurred in the 95 session when the tax credit was renewed. It was first established in 1989, was sunsetted in 1995, and the 95 legislature reapproved the tax credit with these limitations. This was negotiated with then Chair Spoon of the Revenue Committee, who believed that the 50% tax credit that had existed up to that point was too much, and he wished that it was lower than that and settled on the figure of 30%. So that's how it came to be.
Charlie? I think that's in RS 315.164, subparagraph 2.
And I believe you also find it in RS 317.147, the limitation 30%.
Thank you.
I might also add, up till 95, there was no cap on the tax credits. At that point, that's when the 3.3 million tax credit, 3.3 million cap was imposed.
Anyone else?
Mr. Chair.
John.
John McCulley, Tree Fruit Growers. At this point, I'd like to toss in an additional idea that Chairman Mannix had raised during the deliberations of the task force, and that is to allow the tax credit to be used against property taxes that growers pay with a reimbursement mechanism to the local government, so there's no net loss locally, and the cost to the state would be the same. And for the very same reasons that he expressed earlier on the transfer, at least in the fruit industry, and I think a lot of other growers these days are not making any money and therefore don't have income against which to take the tax credit. If that credit could be used against property taxes, we believe it would be very beneficial and allow more growers to participate in the program. And I think there are mechanisms that can be put in place so that local governments are held harmless in that situation.
Any thoughts?
Go ahead. I was just going to say, Susan Castillo. My only concern would be, I know that there are there is accountability built into the tax credit here on how those dollars, on how that would be used. How would you do that with if it was somebody's property taxes? Could you create some kind of an accountability system tied to that so that you would know that, you know, it was going directly into developing housing? And so how would we be able to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, I would envision that the process would continue to be the same. There would just be an option that could be selected by the grower. There are, I believe, in pollution control tax credits, there is an option for cooperatives. I represent cooperatives, so I think I helped get this one, that they, as a nonprofit, can make a choice of using it against property taxes versus income taxes. And I think if we keep the same procedures and same oversight for this tax credit, that we would be protected and the accountability would continue.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Max.
Tax credits, as far as the state is concerned, relate to the income tax, and when we're realistic about it, we understand that a tax credit is really a reduction of revenue. It's a reverse expenditure by the government. And in effect, it's a subsidy mechanism for something that we've decided is a good thing to do. And in this case, if you wanted to go with the property tax credit and you could use the same mechanism, the difference would be that instead of reducing revenue, the state will be writing a check. And the check goes to the county. I like the idea, and I floated the idea, but I have to say, too, that the idea was not incorporated in our final report,
because of the ramifications, political as well as practical, of talking about the state writing a check instead of forbearing on receipt of income tax. And for whatever reasons, there is a psychological shift that occurs when the state has to have somebody take a piece of paper or do an electronic transfer, write that check, and send money somewhere. And the reality is that that's there, and some members of the task force were really not comfortable with that. And since we had a consensus report, we chose not to do that. There may have been a majority of the task force who liked the idea, but we shied away from it because of that. It's certainly up to the committee, and there could be an individual bill that does it, too, as to whether or not that's something you want to do.
I think likely it's a policy debate that we could have in committee, so if you want to draft amendments, you know, I think I'd be inclined to let the amendments stand on their own merits, and I understand the concern that the task force had. And in light of the budget, I think we have to be very careful about what we're going to move forward. We want to move as much forward as we think we can get past this session, and hopefully we'll get some of what we want. And we don't want to put something into a bill that would ultimately kill something that may have moved forward otherwise. But I definitely recognize it. So once this is turned into a bill, if you want to draft amendments, the committee will certainly look at those amendments. And I know Jim Stemmerich would be glad to help have those amendments drafted if you so choose to do that. Any other comments? Yes, Representative May.
I think it's also important to note that everything should be done to make sure that the only other referral that would be necessary would be to revenue as opposed to ways and means. Otherwise, you have two deep, dark pits to traverse. If you are transferring funds to the counties, an argument could be made that it has to go to ways and means.
Okay. You not being with us this year on a full-time basis, they've changed the names to protect the guilty, I think. So now we don't know who anybody is around here, but we're still working on the committee names. So we still call it revenue, though, wistfully. Any other comments or questions on that one? If not, we'll move on to recommendation number 6. Jim, did you want to get slow down?
Chairman, this is one that would transfer oversight of the program, the tax credit program, from DCBS. Or OSHA has been assisting with that or doing that, to the Department of Housing and Community Services.
Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, before the representative from Housing Community Services expresses what a fine idea, I'd like to express that, too. I think Housing and Community Services, with its association with the community development agencies and so forth over the years, are really the logical place for administration of this kind of program. So we strongly support you.
Lynn?
Lynn Partnett, Housing, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood this is not some kind of attempt to make a raid on their programs. This is something that has been a cooperative venture for a long time because we do tax credits, we do housing development, nor OSHA does neither of those things. So as a practical matter, they consult us before they hand out the tax credits. Anyway, I would mention that we have two I don't know if you'd really call them concerns, but I'd like to bring two issues up relating to this in terms of those transition. One would be that they would maintain their current portfolio, and then we would start out fresh. So they would still have the oversight of the old projects, and then we would start fresh with the new projects. We have a whole division that's asset and property management, and so we would like to start fresh with the new projects and monitor those. We would need some administrative money to do that because we would be more actively monitoring the project.
Yes, Representative Max.
I think the monetary issues can be quietly directed separate from this bill without making any kind of appropriation. Two ways and means, simply note that that needs to be done to accommodate the agency funding. Secondly, since Senator Farioli is not in the room,
I do need to point out something that he brought very strongly to the task force and which is incorporated in this recommendation. Although you may have a new taxpayer with new deals with housing and an old taxpayer with old deals with OROSHA, if that one taxpayer has deals with both, the intent is that one agency is going to handle all the tax credits for that taxpayer, that farmer usually, that the farmer does not have to deal with OROSHA on the old ones and housing on the new ones, that those agencies will work together and transfer the accounts one way or the other so that someone with ongoing transactions doesn't have to deal with two different agencies. But someone who only has the old ones can stay with OSHA, and someone who only has new ones can stay with housing. I just wanted to get that on the record so Senator Ferrioli won't get angry with me. Covering.
Yes.
David Sparks, Oregon OSHA. Just wanted to express support for this recommendation. Lynn and I have already had some conversations about the transition process, and we're both agencies are committed to do that. And Representative Mannix, I'm glad you mentioned that. Senator Ferrioli was very vehement in his concern about a taxpayer in Oregon having to deal with two state agencies rather than one, and we will do what's necessary to make that transition as smooth as possible.
Thank you. Anyone else? John.
I'd add, Mr. Chair, John McCulley, Tree Fruit Growers. I'll maybe should save this for testimony on the bill, but we had our group had originally requested the separation and to have or OSHA do the tax credit program for two reasons. One, OROSHA is the regulatory agency, and on the farms, these are places of work. The housing is a place of work that is inspected by OROSHA, so it made sense to us to have that seamless part of the system go because of the housing being inspected by OROSHA. It seemed that they should handle the tax credit. The additional issue that brought us to make this recommendation was a concern over some issues within the housing agency at that time that tended to want to not have any of the housing on farms. And we were concerned that that bias would affect the application of the tax credit program. We feel very comfortable with the energy that's being expended by the housing agency to promote housing in general, and will no longer oppose moving the program from OROSHA to the housing agency.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, well, let's move on to the next one. I think it's number 7, and at this point I'm going to turn the meeting over to Vice Chair Cliff Zonner. And Cliff will have the authority to be speaking for me unless he does something crazy, in which case he's speaking for Representative Leonard.
And that can happen.
Yeah, that can happen.
So, so
go easy on him. He's chairing his first meeting. I have a leadership meeting that I'm actually should have been in 45 minutes ago. And I appreciate all your attendance and your input, and we will put all this together at the end. And we will take these down to legislative councils and draft them in the appropriate manner and then be introducing them essentially as a package and hopefully having them come to the House Business and Labor Committee where we can work those bills, and hopefully we'll see all the familiar faces when we do that. And I like the idea, obviously, is to not only pass the legislation but draw attention to, I think, a significant issue in our state and our community. So with that, I will depart and leave it in the capable hands of Vice Chair's honor. Thank you.
First question before you leave, are we going to meet again at a certain time, or will we establish that here? Will Jim help us with that, or what?
We will have Jim help us with that. I don't know that we're going to have a set time, but we may not need to meet again until these come before committee.
Okay.
So,
thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, recommendation number 7. Jim, you want to talk about that, please?
Yes, recommendation number 7 looks like an effort to put a longer compliance period on the tax credit. I'm not familiar with the background on there, on what the problem is, but 10 years is what has been talked about, and I would need some help along with legislative council on knowing what is meant by that compliance.
And Jim, you can sit up here now. We got an extra chair for you. That's okay. Yes.
I'm Peter Hanley. I'll try and tackle that. What we were attempting to do here is
extend the compliance period that folks have to provide, that the farm worker housing, that stays in farm worker housing for 10 years rather than 5 years. One thing I think we need to be careful on this one is the same as number three, as Charlie was commenting on, is that the compliance is with the owner-operator and not with the investor. That could affect the pricing on these. So however we implement this, we should be considerate of that fact. What we might have seen in the past, I don't know if we actually saw it, but with the five-year compliance, someone could get the tax credits and commit to farm worker housing for only 5 years, and then at that point just take it out of farm worker housing. And what we wanted to do was ensure that it's in a longer term than 5 years.
I'd like to introduce Representative Lowe.
Thank you.
Have a seat.
Mr. Chairman. Lynn Parton, I would just like to add that why it says define a compliance period instead of change a compliance period is because currently there is no compliance period specified, and there's an implied compliance period in the sense that the tax credit can be taken over a five-year period, but there really isn't anything that says that there is a five-year compliance period.
Kevin?
The idea here is then in the statute to be very specific that, hey, if you're going to take advantage of this credit, you will provide farm worker housing for 10 years. But once we put that locked into the statute, we said, on the other hand, we'll allow the director to do a waiver if you show that, and I'll make this, if you're in County X and you needed farm worker housing and you built it, and 8 years from now, for whatever reason, the farming community is devastated and there's no need for that housing, but something else has arisen where you can rent it out and you can get a waiver and say, well, I won't have to continue doing it because there's no need for farm worker housing, but we have this new printing plant that just went up and we could rent housing to these people. The idea was to build in flexibility on that side, but to make it clear that we expect basically that this will be for farm worker housing.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tim Bernasek from the Farm Bureau. I agree. I think the idea of, obviously we've said a number of times that we need more housing and not less. I just would hope that the director on this waiver provision would direct folks, farmers that, you know, as we know, the state of agriculture, particularly in the Willamette Valley, is really in flux, and people are coming in and out of labor-intense crops, and frankly, more out than in, with the exception of the nursery industry. So just would hope that the director then would maybe provide some sort of references on if a waiver is granted to other folks that might assume responsibility for that housing so that it stays in housing, but that a grower doesn't feel that, again, commodities have gone south on him, and now we're stuck into housing, and if the waiver provision be, trying to keep it in housing, that we'd be flexible in the waiver provision, but also provide a lot of references to other folks that might be interested in getting into the housing business and maybe take that over. So it is a concern, obviously, that we have, but we do agree that we ought to have some sideboards on this and have people that are taking advantage of the tax credit use it for the means it was provided.
Any other questions? Yes.
I just was curious about how this provision interfaces with the expansion of who's eligible for the tax credit in recommendation number four. I mean, if this has to now be farm worker housing for a 10-year period and, say, a construction company or a manufacturer got the benefit of the tax credit, would they be liable for repaying the tax credit if it ceases to be farm worker housing in that 10-year period? That's the intent. I see it. No,
Kevin Mannix here. And no, the idea is that it's actually, no, because you want, financial community, for instance, won't want to get into deals where they have to be liable for something the third party does or the person that they lend money to, and the same goes with a construction company. The liability will be with the owner of the property. The owner of the property who manages it needs to make sure that that property continues to be used for farm worker housing unless a waiver is granted. And by the way, the waiver is going to be done by the director of housing, so I would assume or hope that the director of housing will say, well, I'll give you a waiver because you no longer have farm workers in the area, but there are other workers, therefore this must still be used as housing and not converted to office condos or whatever. In terms of this whole process, though, the focus is on
the owner of the property and the manager of the property is the one who needs to make sure the compliance occurs. If they fail, then the onus is on them. And there is obviously a resource, the value of the property, which you can go after to collect on. It's real property. It's got real value in the market. So there is a source for the state to go after if they need to collect for failure to comply. Did I answer your question?
I'm not sure. So they, who would they go after?
They'd go after the farmer, the person
farmer.
Who owns the property. Or the agent that owns the property.
So whoever the owner of
the
property
owner.
Is. Thank you. Kathy Lowe from Oregon City Gladstone area. I believe we had some discussion in committee. I'm not real sure about that.
I wonder if Kathy would speak up, because these microphones around here, and we're feeding the Internet all over the country. So.
Thank you so much, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman. I'm Kathy Lowe. I'm a representative from Oregon City Gladstone area. And I guess my question is for other members of the interim force that worked on this. But I believe we had some discussion on whether or not we were going to extend this obligation out for 20 years to be consistent with some of the other federal housing programs that, for example, Section 8 housing, you can't convert or realize a profit for 20 years. It has to remain as low-income housing or affordable housing for a longer period of time. And I can't remember what our reason was for sticking with the 10 years or whether we had discussion on that. I was wondering if our able chair, Kevin Mannix, could comment on that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Kevin Mannix. There are a couple of elements to the rationale. One, there's a much greater fluctuation in terms of farm worker housing and the market out there because of the changes in agriculture compared to what I'll call other housing programs. Secondly, we're not talking about 100% tax credit. We're talking about a 50% tax credit. If you think of useful life of structures, as some people arbitrarily think of it as 20 years, giving a credit for half. You also look at a compliance period of half. That's sort of rough justice in terms of how you come up with the 10 years. And the other part of it was simply a political compromise that the current requirement is 5 years, although it's not stated in statute. It's implicit in the procedures that are used, and we're doubling that. So we thought that seemed to be aggressive enough. I'm trying to give straightforward answers, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else have some questions? Okay.
Jim Stambridge again. It looks like this addresses ORS 317.147, which refers to, I believe, banks, and it may refer to savings and loans that would allow nonprofit lenders and banks to use tax credits.
Chairman?
Yes.
I just had a question jumped out of me. How does an entity that doesn't pay taxes take advantage of a tax credit?
Who wants that one first?
Kevin Mannix, Mr. Chairman. The idea is I'm a nonprofit. I'm trying to put together a farm worker housing project. The tax credit doesn't do me any good, but I can turn to construction company X, which is a tax paying entity, and could also turn to bank Y. I could turn to a management company, Z, and say to them, look, I need to have you come in. I'm not an expert at doing this stuff. I need to put together this housing for my farm workers or for farm workers in our community. We're a nonprofit. We want to build this housing. It could be a church. Church says we aren't eligible, but if you come in, you can participate. And there'd be a formula that's devised and it's approved by the agency, and you will reduce your taxes. And, in fact, we're going to give you an incentive to come in and construct, finance, and manage this housing for farm workers. That's how it would work.
Peter Hanley, this might be better stated that rather than the banks or the nonprofits using the credits to pass the credits through to a tax-paying entity.
Other questions on that one?
I do.
The discussion. Yes.
Thank you, Kathy Lowe, for the record. We talked about credit unions as well in this context, did we not? And I wondered if Ledge Council needed a note on that.
Mr. Chairman, I just reviewed ORS 317.145, and credit unions are covering that statute now. It needs to be reiterated.
Thank you.
Chairman, recommendation number 9, you'll find on, starting on page 13 of the task force report, and it includes a long list of things.
Excuse me, Mr. Stembridge, Chair of Honor. I just wanted to make one more point on the previous recommendation that it should be that we're allowing nonprofits and banks to make use of these tax credits, but only the farm worker housing tax credit. We don't mean apparently to apply that because this could be read as opening up the way to all tax credits to be eligible for that type of transfer. But specifically the farm worker has in tax credit.
Representative Rosenbaum is correct.
Okay with it. Yes, please. On recommendation number 9, if you'll see page 13, and it goes on to page 14, it's quite a long list of the information that would be designated to Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to facilitate.
Yes?
I was looking at this yesterday and I have a suggestion for where I might go. Maybe I can just pass it around. It would be in 456.559. Currently, we have a provision, sub 3, that talks about the department establishing statewide priorities for housing programs and coordinating those housing programs with the department and other state agencies. And so I thought as long as we were talking about in that statute already, the department's relationship to other state agencies with regard to housing, that it might fit right after that before it starts talking about the director's relationship to the council. So it would come after sub 3 and before sub 4, which would then become sub 5. In 456.559,
and that's just an office suggestion. We aren't led to that at all. May I just remind the group here, what we're talking about is asking the legislative council to do some legislative drafts. These would become committee bills, and then if they're referred back to the business committee, they'll be set for hearing, and at that point we can start talking about the details. What I was hoping, and I think what Representative Knope was hoping for as a result of this meeting, is just what's happening. Pretty generally, we're not getting into the ultimate details, and we're not wordsmithing exactly. That can come later. We just want to have something that's pretty good to put forward for our committee bill. So I thank you for that.
Thank you. Item number 10.
17, yes. This jumps, and the reason it jumps is because what I took was statutory changes. You may wish to discuss, and maybe this is to do on other issues relating to budget or emphasis of administration. What we try to concentrate on is the statutory changes that the task force pointed out as being needed. So that's why we jumped to number 17. This is a task force recommendation number 17, which you'll find on page 17 of the task force report. And it says increased penalties for failure to comply with the farm worker camp registration requirements. The one I found had to do with Foley, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, but I understand that OROSHA also has penalty authority here. And I'm not sure exactly whose penalties are being issued.
David Sparks, OSHA. Subsequent to a meeting that I had with Jim Stembridge on Wednesday, did some research and wanted to let the group know that I don't believe legislation will be necessary unless you so desire to accomplish the doubling of civil penalties for failure to register camps. Currently, Oregon OSHA has an administrative rule that specifically addresses penalties for failure to register, and that rule requires Oregon OSHA to levy a penalty of not less than $250 nor more than $7,000 per violation for each failure to register. This last growing season, we looked over the problem as it related to failure to register, and we established a civil penalty, an automatic penalty of $2,500 for each operator who failed to register with us. And that's what we levy. That's because we have the flexibility to go from $250 to $7,000. We could, by rule, by application of an existing rule, simply double the penalty and have a base of $5,000 for each violation of failure to register a camp. Admittedly, that's by rule. We have that flexibility, and that is what we would do. However, you know, the group may feel that it's something they would rather have crafted in statute and inserted in ORS 654, which is the statute that we administer.
Kevin's next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kevin Mannix, and I know Jim Stembridge tried to get in touch with me, so I've got to say this in advance, because this is not something that we intended to go into the statute. We directed this really towards the agencies and their rulemaking process. They already have enough statutory authority to double the penalties, and we were directing that recommendation to the legislature in the sense that we're making a report, but our intent was that the agencies would revise their rules so that they impose tougher penalties here. There's other provisions in here, too, that will be addressed. I think the Ways and Means as to funding some of the operations, a reward system for reporting violators, for example, which does not require a statutory change. So on this 17, I don't think a statutory change would be indicated. I would also add quickly that it's probably a good idea not to include it in a comprehensive bill if a single bill is being done, because anytime you raise penalties in a bill, you increase opposition by 50%.
Mr. Chair, I shorten my comments based on what former Representative Mannix just said. However, I would note that there is a provision in 658 that does provide for penalties for not registering camps that BOLI can administer, and frankly, Farm Bureau does not object to an increase in those penalties. However, as this is written, this would increase or double penalties for any violation under the chapter, and that is problematic to us. But I think we narrowly focused. I personally don't have heartburn over that, because I think that we in the task force really want to get after these unregistered folks and get them light of day shined upon them. And if penalties are the way to do that, then I don't think we've got a problem with that, just for the record.
Mr. Chairman, a short comment. I concur with the comments of former Representative Mannix with regard to adding this provision to a package of legislation here. I think it would make the sledding somewhat more difficult as this package of legislation moves on to adoption. We certainly want this package to be adopted. There's adequate authority in our OSHA to provide any penalties necessary with the Farm Labor Camps compliance laws. We think that the bill would be a lot cleaner and a lot lighter if this provision were not.
Lynn Parton again. I would just want to comment, it might be worth talking to Bowie, somebody from Bowie. I don't think there's anybody here. Are you willing to do that? Because one of the differences between the civil penalties at Bowie and the civil penalties at Orosha are that Bowie's penalties come to us and we build affordable housing with them for farm workers specifically. And the Orosha money goes into other things. But when it's increased on that side, it has very different consequences than being increased on that side. That was another thing that the task force actually discussed as well.
Kevin?
Well, in terms of how this process could work, should the agencies wish a little backing for this, the Labor Committee can certainly adopt a motion when they're dealing with this legislation to recommend to Ways and Means that there be a budget note which says that the legislature asked the agency to proceed to increase the penalties within their regulatory authority, but you don't need a statutory change to do that, but if the agency is so comfortable. Of course, I think the record that's been established already would make them comfortable with just going ahead and doing it. In fact, they could do it before the session ends. In fact, their budgets could be held up until they did it. Some people had a problem with it. I'm not suggesting they do. That is to make sure that the penalties are increased through the rules. As far as the use of OSHA money towards housing, I would leave that up to whether or not OSHA wants legislation on that. Or they've been using their funds for other purposes, and I think they'll need to help.
David Sparks, Oregon OSHA. in terms of the collection of civil penalties and then transferring those revenues to housing and community services, we don't have any objection with that. I'm not familiar with how that process would actually work, but, you know, would work with whomever's necessary to make that happen.
May I suggest that the one thing that could be done instead of the broader change proposed here is that there simply be an authorization that OSHA transfer the penalties it collects in this context to housing, for purposes of housing, and then you've got that clear authorization for OSHA to do it. And that certainly would not be controversial and would fit in exactly with the scheme that we envisioned. And I think that if there's no objection, that would be probably the way to handle this particular recommendation.
Further comments?
Mr. Chair, yes. I don't mean to bog down in detail here because this will get worked out later, but is the intent, if it is in statute now, that these penalties have to go into a specific place in OSHA's budget, that we amend the statute so that those monies be redirected to the purpose of
that's what I'm recommending. And that one piece of it would...
And that would require statutory change.
How do you feel about that? Anybody have any further discussion on that?
Representative Zahner, members of the committee, David Smart. We are talking about the revenues collected for citations issued for failure to register labor camp. We're comfortable with that.
Bless you again.
Oh, no. She didn't hear it over the sneeze. He just said, we're comfortable with that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there's a recommendation number 18, which you will not see in the package that we're proposing to submit to the Legislative Council. And the reason is that Chairman Oak was not feeling comfortable with that recommendation. That seemed like a pretty wide ranging land use recommendation. There is already a statute that says to local governments and all governments that you cannot discriminate against farm worker housing proposals. As such, that's why we don't see it there. So that's the introduction that I would make.
Mr. Chairman,
I wanted to, before we got into that recommendation, the ones that were skipped over were some of the primary funding ones. And I don't know if this would be appropriate time to talk about some that are skipped over, but you want to wait until...
Mr. Chairman, please take the case.
Yes.
With all due respect, the funding recommendations really have to be directed to ways and means.
Well, I guess the one that I think we could deal with here is recommendation 13, dedicate a portion of existing low-income housing financing programs to farm worker housing. Lynn Parton indicated that there's a 456.559 ORS dealing with powers and duties of the department. And there is one provision in here that says that subparagraph 3, in accordance with the provisions of this section, with the advice of the council, the department shall establish statewide priorities for housing programs. And I think it would be appropriate for this committee to recommend that statute be amended to say one such priority shall be farm worker housing. Because I mean, we've been pushing around this for 10 years. As Mr. McCauley has said, this thing has been, there's been task forces back in the 80s and the 70s dealing with this, and as yet nobody's willing to step forward and put teeth into the practice of giving priority to farm worker housing. And I think that this is a recommendation 13 could actually be an opportunity for this committee and for the state to actually say we do establish this as a priority. We're not just making recommendations here.
I'm going to be very blunt about this, Kevin Mannix. My understanding is that Representative Knope wanted this meeting to be convened to deal with the specific statutory changes that were recommended by the Farm Worker Housing Task Force, statutory changes that his committee could seek and introduce and proceed with, that it was not meant to be a meeting to deal with all the recommendations. We specifically did not make recommendation 13 a statutory recommendation.
because there was some disagreement about how this should be approached. And had we made it a statutory recommendation, we would have said so. Instead, we talked about legislative leadership encouragement. We were trying to give some room to maneuver to the executive branch. I happen to personally agree with your position, and I think it would be welcome to see legislation introduced that raises the issue. But as chair of the task force, I have to say, we specifically did not make that a statutory recommendation, and that goes beyond what Representative Canopa is looking for here, which is what bills do we need. I'll add quickly that when we get to recommendation 18, I'll make the opposite case, saying the committee should have a bill to raise the issue, and if not, some individual legislator should have a bill to raise the issue. That's another story.
Lynn Parton, Housing. I just want to mention for everybody's information, the recommendations 10, 11, and 12, which are funding ones, people can speak to in a different forum. Our budget is up most of next week. The pre-budget presentation is starting this afternoon. We're in from Monday to Thursday in the Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee of Ways and Means at 1 o'clock every day, and there's going to be public testimony available on Wednesday the 31st. So, for instance, there is no migrant million. I just came over here from making a presentation to our state housing council, which is essentially the Board of Governors, about what we did with the last migrant million, but it's zero in the governor's budget, and it means it's zero in our budget. So, if people want something like that, for instance, or more emergency housing funding, we don't get $7.7 million in our budget for that. So if people want to participate in that part of this report, that would be the way to go, I think.
Let's go on to number 8.
18. Mr. Chairman, clarification, please. Jim, did I hear you say that recommendation 18 of the task force will not be included in any legislative package which has been proposed from this work group?
Representative Knope did not ask me to prepare a legislative draft for that. I think someone will need to make a case to him that the committee should consider such a bill.
And now we are going to go on and discuss the merits of recommendation 18 here?
Yes, he indicated to me today he wanted to hear discussion of the issue.
Thank you.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, that was a statutory recommendation. It is arguable that it's more of a land use issue that another committee ought to deal with. It is not so much a labor issue, but it affects labor because it affects farm workers and their availability of housing. Without having had a chance to discuss it with the chairman of the committee, I'll be cautious as to my remarks, but that was a statutory recommendation, and we would hope to see a bill developed to at least allow the issue to gestate and to be addressed in the legislative process. But I also respect the fact that it's up to the chair of the committee to determine whether or not he wants the committee to have such a bill on its agenda for introduction as a committee bill, as opposed to a legislator's bill.
We can do that here, couldn't we? I mean, if we decide to do it. So.
Well, yep. This is what I would suggest. I will talk with the chair, and if necessary, we'll talk with former Representative Manning. And it could be very well be that we'll prepare the legislative draft for possible consideration. I think Representative Manning is correct that if it's a land use thing, it's not going to come back to our committee to deal with. So.
Yes, Chairman, just a comment. I concur that recommendation 18 of the task force should not be brought up as a part of legislation in this package that we're considering today. I see a number of land use planning ramifications from the policy recommendation here that really should be taken up by land use. So I concur that it should be kept out of our recommendation. If we want to do something to benefit farm worker housing, this might not be the way to do it.
I think another issue around recommendation 18 is, I agree if people don't want to have it as part of this package, but I think the issue that at least I was hoping that we were going to be able to get to in whatever our recommendations were is the whole issue of the difficulty in constructing farm worker housing in communities that
would not exist without agriculture and that have been reluctant to develop housing for these workers who help drive the economy that helps their communities exist. And, you know, there has been, beyond the fact that it's very difficult to do this kind of housing financially, here are people who have been doing this work for a long time, and there's just incredible barriers to overcome as you're trying to put these packages together for funding and make them, you know, at an affordable level for this workforce, but also dealing with the whole issue of the attitudes of these communities to not want those people living, you know, in those developments for a variety of reasons. It could be that they don't understand what that housing would look like, and they're afraid of what it could, you know, how it would impact their communities. There's racism definitely involved here, and I think we need to admit that. And I think that, you know, I was hoping that we were going to take that issue up on how we can help these communities. I think part of it is an education and helping them understand that if we do this, it helps the economy of agriculture. And so, you know, I wanted us to really, as we were putting this package together, to really talk about that and address that issue and help communities overcome, you know, the barriers that have existed in those communities on this issue. And so I guess part of it, I saw part of that happening here. I realized the whole land use thing is a very hot button issue. I have no idea that we would be able to accomplish much in that arena, but I was hoping we could, you know, make some headway on that issue with those various communities in our state. So.
In response, I live in Woodburn, and I own a radio station, and we played Real Old Country. I called it Tombstone Country. If they weren't dead, I didn't play it. And I knew that for all Spanish, so I'm used to running into that bigotry constantly, and I understand what you're talking about. And we certainly need to do some publicity there and some addressing of those issues. We need to educate them.
I mean, absolutely.
So hopefully in the next generation, they'll all die off. But, man, I run into that.
Is that KWBY?
Yeah. Really? Yeah, you got it. and the farmers would call me and say, God, get that Mexican stuff off of me. I would say, hey, you know, that's what pays the bills. You guys aren't buying the ads. So they and they learned. So I did a mix for a long, long time. And, I had some barriers to overcome that.
Yeah? Mr. Chairman, I also think some folks need to understand that Recommendation 18 is actually, and I love to say this, a limitation on land use restrictions, because it's the reverse of the mindset. Usually the state sets some mandatory minimum level and imposes it on local government, and counties and cities complain saying, you're forcing us to do something. Well, here we're turning the tables and saying, this is the worst you can do. This is the maximum restriction you can impose, because we're dealing with the NIMBY syndrome, the not in my backyard syndrome. And we're saying, here is a reasonable standard. You can't go any higher than this standard in allowing the development of farm worker housing. Complete reverse spin. And that's where I think we'll need to have some conversations with folks to help them understand it. And I was just thinking about this after a remark I made to Representative Rosenbaum that, well, we always have Measure 7 issues. Actually, this is the opposite of Measure 7 issues, because this is telling counties they can't go any further. And the problem we have right now is some counties have gone too far in their bureaucratic procedures and in their fees and in their restrictions that make it hard to build farm worker housing.
Representative Zara, Mr. Chair, Committee again, Tim Bernasek. I just wanted to echo and build upon Senator Castillo's concern that that's a problem that we have on farm housing, trying to site the housing there as well. We've run into those problems, particularly Washington County. We've had, I think that's a poster child county for that type of concern. So building on everything she said, it's not just communities, it's out in farm on farms where it's supposed to, it's zoned, all the zoning laws provide for farm worker housing as part of the zoning, but we still have roadblocks that are thrown in the way there as well. So it's a very important issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy Lowe from Oregon City Gladstone area. I agree with Senator Castillo that this is a very important issue that needs to have open dialogue in a public forum. And to that end, I'm wondering if we present it as a standalone statute or a standalone issue to showcase it somewhat more dramatically than burying it in a large omnibus bill might be a good way to go. we want to affect these changes because it's going to do a great deal of good for a whole lot of people, both landowners as well as the workers in the industry. And I'd like to see this package go forward as best we can. But I would hope that this committee would encourage the chair of the recipient committee to allow recommendation 18 to be heard in tandem with the other bills, but not necessarily as a part of the package.
Well, the one other thought I have is actually, since the land use related committees are going to be so bogged down with other issues, maybe we ought to have a relating clause that actually makes it more of a labor-related relating clause and get it in front of the labor committee so that the issue committee can be considered.
That works for me.
Can you do that for us?
That's assuming that the business committee is not equally bogged down with many, many issues.
Mr. Chairman, Scott Ashton with the Oregon Association of Nursing, I just want to agree with Senator Castillo on this point and pledge to work with her for passage of legislation which includes the concept in Recommendation 18 of the task force. The Oregon Association of Nursing agrees with this recommendation. Our reason for not supporting this land use concept coming in the package of bills that will be before this committee is technical. For example, accessory farm dwelling is right now permitted easily by virtually every county in the state. For farm workers, accessory farm dwelling can be and often is used for farm workers. But you first have to have a primary residence established on that farm. Does this statement in the land use context say that we should give priority to accessory farm dwellings over principal farm residences when one must have a principal farm residence on the farm before they're eligible to build the easily attainable accessory farm dwelling? Technical matters like that come from this, but if we had just this statement written out in a freestanding bill, the Oregon Association of Nursemen would support you in working towards passage of that bill.
Well, you know, I also know we need to be careful, and I am very protective of our land use laws and vote with Farm Bureau on all those bills because I get that. But, you know, I just see this. I don't even know that this is the ideal way to go about what we're trying to do, but I just know that I would love to see us have a discussion about it and figure out some kind of a solution. It would be great.
Or you forget about it, leave your business cards here, and you'll have the correct spelling of everybody.
Yeah, I don't need it from the legislators. I know who you are. But anybody else, if you can, before you leave, if you can drop your business card here so I can spell your name right.
Representative Lowe.
Mr. Chair, before we close, I just wanted to say how honored I was to be allowed to participate on this committee and how impressed I was with the chair's able and gracious and even diplomatic. Surprising. bringing together divergent issues, but I want to thank all the people in the building and who frequent these halls for their hard work on this, but I especially wanted to thank those people who participated on this committee who do not ordinarily frequent these halls. Many people from across this state came and worked long hours and hard hours to bring these recommendations to you, and it was a real privilege to work with the growers and the laborers, and especially Geronimo. Oops.
Antonio.
Jim
trying to give us an update.
Who gave his time to this committee. So, and with that, I must exit stage left, but I'll be back. Thanks.
I just wanted to briefly say to you my intentions. If there's any difference, let me know. I'll talk with Representative Knope about it. But I see four bills. One bill with our numbers 1, 2, 6, and 9. These have to do with housing policy, the Department of Housing and Community Services. A second bill having to do with tax credits would include recommendations number 3, 4, 5, 7, and 8. And then I will talk to Representative Knope about a bill that would transfer OSHA penalty collections to housing. That's not included in the recommendations. came up here tonight, and I will also talk to him about implementing number 18, if he wants to do with recommendation number 18. So that'd be four bills that I...
I just had a quick question. I know Senator Farioli had some things in Recommendation 17 that he was advocating for on the notices, the farm deferral notices. Is there any reason why that is not included in any of the discussion yet today?
Which recommendation is
it was recommendation number
17,
which talked about the penalties. We also had some long discussions about notifications in the farm deferral to farmers, letting them know what the rules are on whether or not they may have a farm labor on their property and the need to register. And that wasn't discussed in the recommendation 17 that's been put together.
Can I address that?
Yes, Kevin.
Kevin Manners here. Actually, the only reason why that's not in the legislative, because it'd be another ways and means thing where they would simply provide the funding and the direction to the agency that you would not need statutory authorization as long as Ways and Means has provided the funding mechanism. There are several things here where we will need to make sure that we can work with the agencies and get them to go to Ways and Means. And I'm prepared to appear in front of the appropriate subcommittees and make sure that when they do the budgeting, that they include those directives.
Just for the record, I want to say that Ramon Ramirez, the president of PECUN, he would like to keep being involved in these proceedings and have notice of it. Thank you.
We'll keep him that. Thank you.
Anything else before the committee?
Thanks.
Thank you.